Mesdames et messieurs, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Je suis Antonia Mahoney, directrice de l'Institut d'études canadiennes de l'Université McGill. Il me fait un très grand plaisir de vous souhaiter la bienvenue à cette conférence annuelle de l'Institut d'études canadiennes de l'Université McGill. Et je tiens également à vous remercier d'être venu en si grand nombre ce soir. This evening we launched the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada's 2009 annual conference. Since 1995, the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada has hosted important annual conferences whose aim has been to foster informed, nonpartisan discussions of public policy issues affecting Canadians. And we have, for over a decade, used this conference as a way of focusing attention to a wide variety of issues, such as Aboriginal peoples, youth, citizenship, healthcare, media, food policy, culture, international affairs, even Canada relations, and the teaching of Canadian history. Through the years, we convened dozens, hundreds of speakers, and gathered together thousands of informed Canadians at these conferences, whose common theme has been what matters to Canadians and to the future of Canada itself. With this as a backdrop, it seemed especially relevant in 2009 to turn the tables and to examine what it is that actually drives public policy and public policy making. When we first began planning this conference, we were inspired by Max Bell Foundation Fund interdisciplinary research project here at McGill, examining the actors in public policy making. We were interested in whether the public policy making process was in crisis. But as we moved forward, we realized the other side of the coin of that question. How is public policy making itself affected by crisis? And that ultimately is the question on many people's minds today, and why we are so very honored to have the Minister of Finance, Honorable James Flaherty, speak to us as a leader in a time of crisis. I want to mention now that there will not be a question period from the floor after the Minister's speech, and I hope you can all appreciate that the Minister has been very gracious with his time in this exceptionally busy, busy time, and that we are extremely fortunate to have him here this evening. Nous sommes aussi très heureux d'accueillir ce soir Mme Heather Malum, principale et vice-chancelière de l'Université McGill. Universitaire accomplie et administratrice distinguée dans les domaines de l'épidémiologie et de public, la professeure Monroe Bloom est membre de la Faculté de médecine de l'Université McGill. Like the Honorable Minister, Dr. Monroe Bloom has a childhood link to Montreal, and we are delighted that they are back in their hometown together. In addition to her numerous honors, Dr. Monroe Bloom was recently awarded the title of Grand Montréalaise, Montreal's highest honors. Félicitations. Ladies and gentlemen, the Principal and Vice Chancellor of McGill University, Dr. Heather Monroe Bloom.
Merci beaucoup, Antonia, et grand bienvenue à tout le monde. Nos invités distingués, le Premier ministre Clark, Monsieur le ministre Flaherty, le gouverneur de McGill, nous étudions vraiment la richesse de McGill dans nos étudiants et mes chers collègues. C'est pour moi un grand, grand plaisir d'avoir cette opportunité de faire une introduction de notre ministre, mais aussi de dire quelques mots aux importances de cet institut et aussi cette conférence. I want to commend my colleague Antonia Mahoney and her predecessor Des Morton for the extraordinary leadership that they've brought to the McGill Institute for the Study of Canada, to having a forum which every year attracts an exceptional crowd as it has here. I want to say as well how happy we are to have the Clerk of the Privy Council, Kevin Lynch, and Senator Leo Colbert with us. It is always great turnout, and as Antonia has said, what time could be more important than looking at the role of public policy, how to have constructive public policy developments, to have the interaction of policy institutes, think tanks, at this moment when we're really looking at new directions. And I'll leave it to our guest speaker to tell us exactly how to think about those new directions. It gives me a particular personal pleasure to welcome Minister Jim Flaherty here. He is not a son of McGill, but he's brother of a son of McGill. and has links to McGill, and as Professor Mahoney said, to Montreal as well. He was a Loyola grad. I've been asked to say he's a distinguished alumnus at Princeton University. I came to know Minister Flaherty when he was finance minister in Ontario under the Harris and then Eves government, and he was at that time member of Parliament for Whitney, Oshawa. Minister of Finance, Minister responsible for the Greater Toronto Area at the same time. He's been a governor of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. From 1995 to 2005, Minister Flaherty served as member of Ontario Legislature for Whitby Ajax and as Deputy Premier, Minister of Finance, Attorney General, and Minister of Labour. No small set of achievements. And that doesn't even get to the event of what he's responsible for right now. But I do want to say, as a former Ontario professor and someone who worked in the research and international relations area at a critical time in public policy development and support of universities and science and scholarship and the very beginning of the innovation agenda, that then Mr. Flaherty and his Ontario role played a fundamental leadership role in bringing forward a set of recommendations to innovate new programs at the provincial level that would allow Ontario to compete with a new suite of programs that our clerk was so involved with creating in the years prior to that, understanding that no jurisdiction can succeed in this era without its own strategy, but a strategy leveraged to support success in federation and then leveraged on that to support international impact through quality, through talent, through the production of new ideas, and indeed through the exchange of new ideas. And Mr. Flaherty, you've shown an appetite and an energy for leading on this in the moment I met you, and you've continued through with that. Those of you who have followed closely recent budgets will know that Minister Flaherty not only brought in a very strong stimulus budget in January, but was indeed a leader in understanding that stimulus budgets that only support, all as important as these may be, that only support the building of roads and bridges and construction that's not intrinsically linked with the creation of a platform for the retention and attraction of talent, the production of knowledge, and a sense that we're building something for the medium and long term, as well as working to get ourselves out of a crisis. For all of that, we were enormously grateful that Minister Flaherty and the Government of Canada chose to create a $2 billion knowledge infrastructure program in this budget, and indeed to invest in the Canada Foundation for Innovation and a new program of infrastructure support for universities and colleges, particularly around the themes of Advantage Canada, which is a science framework for driving policy in that realm going forward. These buildings are beautiful, for those of you who may be newly on the McGill campus today, but we have some 55 buildings that have been in use for over 70 years continuously on our two campuses, housing some of the 900 professors we've attracted from around the world in less than 8 years, using the Canada Research Chairs, the Canada Foundation for Innovation, and other supports, but without the capacity to really attack fundamentally the infrastructure needs required to support that talent, our wonderful students moving into the future. So we're exceptionally grateful for your wisdom in understanding how important this is. We know you'll get to the granting councils as we move forward. And enough said on that, but very happy to have the strong support of the federal government for research, talent, and innovation. The ability of our universities, of course, to carry out cutting-edge research across a broad range of disciplines is key positioning the country to compete in the knowledge society around the world and to ensure our future prosperity. And, Minister Flaherty, your government has supported us to do just that. And I want to make special mention not only of the new infrastructure fund, but indeed of the superb new Canada Excellence Research Chairs Program. This is a program that is aimed at attracting the very best of the best from around the world to 20 exceptional positions, understanding how important it is that Canada not be protectionistic in the way we think about supporting talent, and that countries that are willing to put themselves out there and compete on the world stage with the very best, as our mission says, with other institutions and jurisdictions that share the highest of international standards of excellence. That is exactly what the Canada Research Chairs Program is, and what a wonderful tool for us at a moment when the whole world is wondering how to take the next step forward. And then in addition to that, understand that along with these very elite senior positions, we absolutely must be able to compete through graduate fellowships and innovative, entrepreneurial, and forward-looking jurisdictions attract students into graduate students, recruiting from the very best around the world, and the NA program will allow us to do that. So thank you for that. I'm not going to take any longer but to introduce you with a deep appreciation for being here today at the launch of our annual Miss Convents, and for all you're doing to bring some leadership to positioning the country to go forward positively. Thank you.
Premier Ministre, Mesdames, Messieurs, c'est un grand plaisir d'être ici ce soir à McGill. Je voudrais dire quelques mots au sujet du budget fédéral et des défis, des enjeux fédéraux au Canada. It is a pleasure to be here with you tonight. I look forward to sharing with you some of the work that we've done and the steps that we've taken in the last number of months in terms of crisis decision making or policy development in time of crisis. I will try not to go on too long. I'm mindful of the tendency for politicians to do that. In fact, one of my favorite politicians was the finance minister in Ireland. He's now the Taoiseach, which is what they call the prime minister in Ireland. And he told me the story about the Irish politician who was giving a speech in a room like this, went on a bit too long, and people were leaving by that door, and then the back door, and then the other door. And gradually, the crowd was diminishing until he was down to just one person. And the Irish politician stopped and said to the gentleman who had remained in the room, I really want to thank you, sir, for your courtesy, your decency, in hearing it on my speech. And the gentleman said, don't thank me, I'm the next speaker. So I hope you'll stay in the room. If I see you starting to leave, then I'll stop. It is a pleasure to be here. The title of this conference, Public Policy Crisis, is well chosen. I've spoken on more upbeat themes, of course, but a few that are so timely. The logo, though, of the conference, where is it? There's another matter. Oh, yes, it's not. This is the McGill logo. The logo of the conference had the Peace Tower on Parliament House in Ottawa with a crack in it. Perhaps it's a nod to our government's ambitious infrastructure program, which includes the rehabilitation of federal buildings, or maybe it's a tribute to our success in dollars flowing from Parliament Hill in record time. Anyway, I'm sure the logo is well-intentioned. I hope my address will help shed some light on policymaking in Canada, especially in a time of crisis. And there are people here today who have certainly participated in this. Budget policy making, and budget making is really policy making in a broad sense in Canada, involves a lot of people. And as I say, some of them are here. But I'll try to give my perspective, at least as a Minister of Finance. Aiming particularly, it was different in the past 5 or 6 months than the past the 3 years that preceded those months. I've done 4 budgets now. I think that they tell me, the Library of Parliament, that's some kind of record in minority government that 4 budgets passed. So I'm happy about that. The first 3 now seem like sort of walks in the park compared to the last one. And I'll come back to that. This is an opportune time to talk about. Let me talk for a moment about where we are, and then I'll talk a little bit about how we got to this place. As of April 1st, which is next Wednesday, our government will have the authority to proceed with roughly $20 billion in stimulus spending. That's because the first Budget Implementation Act passed through the necessary stages and has an assent March 12th. This $20 billion represents close to 90% of stimulus contained in the budget in Canada's Economic Action Plan. In an unprecedented synchronized global recession, this is, in our view, the kind of support and the magnitude of support that Canada's economy needs. Internationally now, where we are, as I just returned 10 days ago from the meeting of the finance ministers, central bankers of the G20 in West Sussex. I remember where we were. It was a big place in the country, in England. And next week, the prime minister, of course, will be going to the G20 leaders meeting. The finance ministers, I will also be joining the prime minister in London for that, the London Summit, as it's being called, which is a very important meeting, of course, in this crisis. Including an agenda to stabilize financial markets, that is to fix the banks, not the Canadian banks, which are fine, thank you, but to fix the banks in the United States and some of the European banks, restore the flow of credit, and support global economic growth. Now, a global recession would certainly meet the definition of a crisis, so let me return to the title of this conference about public policy making in a time of crisis. I'd argue that's actually more fitting subject, that we're talking about creating policy in a time of crisis. The global situation is unprecedented, changing rapidly. At times it is deeply unsettling. Canada is not an island. Global conditions are affecting Canada. Canadian workers are losing their jobs. The unemployment figures continue to worsen. This is, of course, a matter of grave concern to all of us in Canada, to all of us in public life in Canada. Fans, business, and communities are hurting. This is indeed a time of crisis. But is public policy making in crisis? I'd argue that it is not. The policy decisions we have made as a government to reflect and respond to the current situation, we must do what it takes now to protect Canadians during the current global storm. But we must not lose sight of the fact that it wasn't the best interest of Canadians, and the Canadian economy also relates to the long term. And Heather referenced that in the beginning about the need to make sure that as we take steps to address immediate problems like employment and the need for retraining in some industries and so on, that we don't lose sight of our longer-term objectives as they are set in Vantage Canada. In fact, the choices we've made and the choices we will make in addressing the immediate crisis have to address those long-term goals as well, which are set in Advantage Canada. When we became the government in 2006, it became apparent quite quickly that we did not have, the government did not have, this government, a long-term plan for the Canadian economy. We worked on that in 2006, published Advantage Canada in October 2006, and that is the long-term plan, including the medium term, that we look at as we take action in each of the budgets that have followed that plan. The budget is a comprehensive response to the broader challenge we face. It is a lack of confidence which originated in a global liquidity crisis and which is now doing serious damage to our economy. I mentioned the budget as a policy document, which is really what it is. It has lots of numbers in it, of course, and lots of maps, but it is really a comprehensive policy document, particularly the budget this year, Canada's Economic Action Plan. The budget bill, for example, would have tax measures. This year's first budget bill had tax measures, yes, tax reduction as a stimulus to the economy, about $20 billion, but also had the spending stimulus measures in the budget bill itself. So that was a large step, which caused the opposition some pause, but they at the end decided that this is what we need to do. The bill is now, as I said, we also have authority now, because estimates passed last night. This is archaic parliamentary procedure, but we have an additional $3 billion that, with Treasury Board approval, can be spent in the next few months. It's vitally important. These funds need to be spent now in Canada. They're no good if this stimulus enters the economy a year from now or 2 years from now. In fact, it can be damaging, because it can be inflationary later on. So we've pushed pretty hard, and I've pushed pretty hard in front of a Senate committee. I pushed very hard to say, you know, senators, you need to do this now. Don't take a March break holiday. Deal with the bill now. And they did, to their credit. It's not easy also for government to act this quickly. There's a large organization. There are processes in place which are good processes to make sure that proper safeguards are taken with respect to the spending of your money, of taxpayers' money. But at the same time, there's the broader risk, which in my view is a more important risk, and that is the risk that the economy will worsen, that we will not take the necessary steps, more Canadians will lose their jobs, that there won't be adequate retraining funds available. But that is the greater risk to Canada and to Canadians than the risk of perhaps having some the odd mistake made as we go through the stimulus funding. So where were we? I'm going to go back a bit and go back to August 2007. The finance ministers and central bankers had been in Australia for a meeting. We have lots of meetings, I assure you, G7, G8, G20, APEC, World Bank, IMF. If meetings could solve this crisis would have been solved a long time ago, I assure you. But we come back from Australia in August 2007. The Secretary of the Treasury called me. It was at that time, Mr. Paulson, and we started talking about what was happening to subprime mortgages in the United States. That wasn't the genesis of the problem, in my view, but it was where the problem showed itself. It became apparent that there was a significant problem in credit markets. That was the fall of 2007. There was no clear effect in real economies. There was concern in the United States with the housing bubble bursting back then. The monetary policy report went back and looked at it. The Bank of Canada report, October 2007, that was Governor Dodge's last report. It had the U.S. economy growing 1.9% in 2007, 2.1% in 2008, digital GDP, 3%, a rebound in 2009, I wish. This is, I say, about 18 months ago. I say all this in terms of context, so you see what has happened rather dramatically in this very recent period of time. The Canadian economy at that time, the bank thought the Canadian economy would grow 2.6% in 2007, 2.3% in 2008, 2.5% in 2009. The bank at that time was predicting the price of crude oil near $80 U.S. per barrel through early 2000 and before easing to around U.S. $74 per barrel in 2009. In the autumn of 2007, I was in New York with the various investment banks at the time. I do mean at the time. None of them are heads of investment banks anymore. And what was being said around the tables when we met in the autumn of 2007 was, well, this will be about 6 months, and we'll get through this. This is a credit crisis. It's a financial market issue. It doesn't relate to the real economy now. 6 months or so, everything will be back to normal. As you know, that didn't come to pass. When we got to 2008, the credit crisis worsened. We had the investment bank failures in the United States, the bank failures, regional banks in Germany. bank failures ultimately in the United Kingdom, and then we started to see some slowing in the real economy. But even then, when I go back and look at my own notes from August 2008, my own department was telling me we were on track for budgetary surplus, and we were at that time. Growth was flat, but we were still on track for a surplus in the fiscal year that is just ending. The global fallout from the U.S. slump was starting to be felt, but it was a flattening of the economy at that time, and we saw that throughout the G7. They say there was some softening of the global economy then, but no one was predicting a recession for Canada. And that was where we were, as I say, in August. I have an annual retreat. We're at Meech Lake that year, where I invite Canadians, prominent Canadians, and to come and give me advice as finance minister, and they did that on August 19th, 2008. What we talked about was the U.S. housing situation, not yet bottomed out, support for entrepreneurship, some tax reform ideas about capital gains. We talked about the environmental issues, accelerated appreciation, but not much about the Canadian economy, and that was not long ago, in August 2008. The theme coming out of that meeting, which we had 2 days of, was steady as she goes, basically, for Canada, that we were on track and that we should carry on. As I say, no one was predicting at that point a recession for Canada. So we move into September 2008, and there was a federal election call for October 14th. Later in September, the G7 phone calls among finance ministers began to intensify. We talked to each other fairly often, but it became frequent with respect to the concerns related to the stability of the international financial system, particularly in the United States. Hank Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury at the time, eventually in late September proposed a plan for the government of the United States to acquire illiquid assets. I know that sounds familiar to some of you with the announcements this week about toxic assets. At that time, the term toxic assets had not yet invented. At that time, were illiquid assets, but they're still there in some places, so we're still addressing that problem of fixing the banks. The G7 finance ministers agreed, again, this is early October of last year, to say this, which we didn't communicate. We said, we are ready to take whatever actions may be necessary, individually and collectively, to ensure the stability of the international financial system consistent with our domestic circumstances. And there are variances, obviously, in the domestic circumstances. Canada, as you know, has the most sound financial system in the world. The World Economic Forum and others say that. There were a series of calls, and this is all in the context now, if you're talking about policymaking in a time of crisis, there's action going on, federal action going on, and the world economy was starting to deteriorate. There were a series of calls about that. The financial system woes began to spread. We're into October 2008, still in an election campaign. The frequency of my conversations with the Prime Minister accelerated, as one would expect. In fact, you know, we became talking buddies quite a bit during early October 2008. The Bank of Canada with Governor Carney, the bank CEOs in Canada, and the CEOs of the life insurance companies, the largest, all of us were engaged in this discussion, as were the Government Department of Finance, of course, and Privy Council Office, and the Prime Minister's Office, with this issue. Now, it's unusual in the course of a federal election campaign or any election campaign in Canada for major policy decisions to be made. It's just not tradition, for good reason, and the government sort of a caretaker of government during the period of a general election. Now, you always have to have a government, of course, so the government remains in place, the Prime Minister, the cabinet, and so on. It did come to pass during the last week of the campaign that the Prime Minister agreed that it was necessary that we take some action to demonstrate our support of the Canadian financial system, which we did on Friday, October 10th last year, when we announced that we would a purchasing program that the CMHC would purchase mortgages from the banks that were government Canada insured mortgages in any event. It was a way of providing capital to our banking system and demonstrating to the world that we would support our Canadian financial system, which we did, as I say, on Friday, October 10th. That was also the day that the G7 finance ministers and central bankers were meeting in Washington, and that was a remarkable meeting. I've been to lots of these meetings. Most of them result in rather long communiques that are many pages long, very few people read. This conference was different. Hank Paulson began the Secretary describing the banking situation in the United States. The comments that followed, he invited them to be forthright. They were forthright, I can assure you. There were people that were very unhappy in the room, both ministers and central bankers. The result of that, I think, was a very important weekend in Washington, October 10th, 11th, that time. What happened was that the G7 ministers and bankers decided on a five-point agenda, which we agreed to, five clear points, no big, long communique. We met the following morning with the president, the then president of the United States, President Bush, at the White House. He endorsed the High Points. We then went to the IMF meetings, a meeting of the G20 later in the day, which President Bush also attended. We had a special meeting of the Council of America, the finance ministers of North, Central, and South America. All of us endorsed the 5-point. And this was a turning point, in my view, in terms of the international approach to what we were facing. And this was a crisis. I mean, the concern on the Friday was quite clear that markets would do very badly the following week, and that necessary for clear action to be taken that would be perceived around the world as a clear action, which is what happened that weekend. The election followed in Canada the following Tuesday, October 14th. And I remember election day because at 7 o'clock in the morning, again, was on the phone with the G7 finance ministers, and Secretary of the Treasury, Paulson, was explaining to us how much money the U.S. government was going to put into the U.S. banking system and how essential this was. These were dramatic moves being done fairly quickly over a relatively short period of time. So there, that was in October. We went into November. We were preparing the fall economic update, which is not a budget, a snapshot of where the economy is. We're at a time now when you look back on it, and one of my American colleagues said to me recently, he said, what happened in November or so with the economy is that all was on the table, and it rolled off the table, and still hasn't hit the floor. And we didn't know then, of course, no one did, that the Canadian economy would begin a recession in the last quarter of 2008. No one had predicted it, but indeed, and the depth of the negative growth in the United States economy during the last quarter of last year. So we gave the fall economic statement. It was basically a snapshot at the end of November 2008, saying we're flat, but it looks okay going into the end of the fiscal year. Things continue to deteriorate. As you recall, we had a political crisis. We had the opposition parties that decided they were a coalition, and there was great concern about all of that. We made the decision to do an early budget, the earliest budget in modern Canadian history, which was delivered on January of 27th. Also made, I think, a very important decision in terms of sources of decision-making, and that was to do what is probably the largest, broadest consultation that has ever been done in preparation of a budget in Canada. This was not something that just happened. This was a deliberate choice we made at the beginning of December, that we had about 6 weeks or so to consult, and that we would do that, and we would continue through the Christmas season, and we would do it very broadly. The consultations included, as you would expect, the bank CEOs. I remember the bank CEOs talking to me about cheap government money outside Canada, impairing their ability to compete. Who would have thought the Americans would have been semi-nationalizing their banks? Things were changing remarkably during December and January. The CEOs, of course, I talk regularly to some of our retailers because, as you know, in their systems, they can tell you who bought what last night across Canada. It's a very good measure of where we are. The university presidents, of course, the provincial territorial ministers of finance. And we did meet together. We met together in November where we addressed the issue of equalization, which was growing at a rate that was not sustainable. So we presented a plan with the provincial territorial ministers of finance that the equalization in Canada would not grow at a rate greater than the growth of the economy, which at times seemed like a good idea. But, of course, equalization is an issue that never goes away, and it comes back again with concerns being expressed from time to time. When we did meet, though, and this is a good thing about our country, when we met in a time of crisis in the middle of December in Saskatoon, the provincial territorial and me as the federal minister, and as the attitude at the table of all of the ministers was that we have to participate together, we have to cooperate and collaborate in order to address this issue. This has been followed through. We did the budget early federally, so we provided some cover, arguably, for some of the provinces who might have hesitant to make the incremental infrastructure spending that they need to make a difference this year when Canadians need their help, and have followed through with their budgets, including, I might say, the budget of the province of Ontario this afternoon, which was presented at Edmonds Park. So there was a good sense of cohesiveness there. It was clear with the provincial ministers that they agreed that we needed to do infrastructure spending. They wanted to broaden the definition of infrastructure. This is policy development. I agreed with them. This has been referred to earlier by Heather. We look at not just asphalt and not just bridge repairs, but broadband at university labs, at community college skill training centers. These are all important parts of a recovery. And as I say, we have this broad agreement to do that. Things like InfoWay, electronic health records, vitally important to the provinces as they try to manage their health care costs efficiently and effectively. We did 5 regional roundtables. We used to, in finance, when I started, we had the usual thing was every lobbyist in the country would want to come see the departmental people and the minister and tell them, you know, the meetings were about, here's what I want from the government, right? These are not edifying meetings. But we changed that in the past couple of years. We did it again this year. Instead, we invite people from Walk Life in Canada, sits around a round table this year in St. John, Montreal, and the GTA in Toronto, and Saskatoon, Victoria, for a full day, and we ask them to look at the big pictures. People from different walks of life, some university presidents, college presidents, business people, bankers, professionals, union leaders, and look at various issues and give their recommendations as a group, and that has proven to be very useful. That's when it became apparent to me, certainly listening at those roundtables, that the number one issue in the country was access to credit. What followed from that, access to financing, what followed from that was extraordinary financing framework in the budget, which will create about $200 billion worth of financing availability. In Canada, we're opening now an access to financing committee of experts. These are people from the private sector who have advised the Minister of Finance about how we make sure that we fill in the gaps in lending in Canada as we go through what is going to be a difficult year. It also became apparent in the roundtables that stimulus was needed. And again, even moving away from government people and talking with private sector people, they wanted stimulus broadly defined, not just bricks and mortar, not just roads and bridges, but also looking at the broader issues, including research and including innovation, because that's the way we exit from the recession in a position of strength. We also did something new, appointed an economic advisory council. This has been very helpful to the government. It's been very helpful to me. These are some leading Canadians who continued to meet. We met 2 days ago here in Montreal. Every person called and said, please help. They get paid $1 a year. I think if they even get $1, they may not. They all said yes. No one said no. Canadians want to help their country. They just need to be asked. We had 4 long meetings in different cities in the country. I attended them. They attended them. Great advice to the government. And not only advice about here's what you ought to do, but advice about here's what you ought not to do. And there are a lot more ought-not decisions that are made in budget preparation, public policy, than there are let's do this. And those ones don't get announced, of course, the ones we decide not to do. But they're pretty important because public policy and budget making, of course, involves choices between various options. Meetings of that group were the EAC, the Economic Advisory Council, were very helpful. As I say, they're continuing, and I appreciate what all of those people have done to help their country. In the public consultation, staff, I can tell you, said, Minister, you don't want to go and do public consultations because people are mad at you and various other things, right? This happens in politics. And I said, you know, we have to listen. And it was a good lesson. I've been elected for quite a while provincially and federally. It was a really good learning point for me to go and do one in Vancouver, one in the GTA, and basically say next to nothing. Just say, good evening, sit down, and listen, and take notes. And at one of them, I got a standing ovation at the end. And I've been missing this all along. If I don't talk, I get a standing ovation. So I see I haven't learned the lesson very well since I'm talking tonight. But there is this need, this is a human need, I think, for people in government and responsible positions to listen. So that we show that we understand, and of course one learns by listening. I learned a lot about the EI system, for example, some of the holes in that system that led to some of the reforms that are now law in Canada as of this month. Lots of submissions and writing. A website, of course. The website got tens of thousands of submissions, which creates a lot of work for the Department of Finance and going through them all, but very helpful. And again, as in the roundtables, comments by people in different cities, different parts of the country tend to coalesce. Attitudes tend to coalesce. Identification of the issues tends to become clear in all parts of the country. This is verified when one looks at the electronic input through the website. I met with the economists as well, and I'm not going to say anything about economists. Bill Watson's here. The economists were having difficulty, let's say, at that time. So were we. And trying to gauge what was happening and what was going on and how deep was net growth going to be. I continue to be involved, as the government is, through DFID and other, with the United States, with the European Union, more and more contacts with the Americas, with our concern with the Americas, with the the various countries in South America, including Chile, which have had economic success, but the credit challenges, the financial market challenges, were starting to affect some of the countries that had not been affected to date. Continuing discussions, of course, with the governor of the bank and with the superintendent of financial institutions, really just federally, to try to see what was happening in Canadian financial institutions and in our financial system. Most of that news was good, but changes taking place that had to be watched. Another reason why we created the extraordinary financing framework in the budget. Now, while this is accelerated, I have to compliment everyone, of course, in the Department of Finance. Rob Rice, the deputy minister, and people worked through Christmas and New Year's. We knew that the budget had to be ready very early, January 27th. The prime minister, of course, worked through that time as well, as did the clerk of Privy Council and the Privy Council office, the prime minister's, the PMO, prime minister's office, which Jean Brody used to lead. Everybody worked hard in order to distill what was being heard and deal with the briefings that we had to do with the Prime Minister inside the Department of Finance. This is how all this works. Lots of you sit on tables and listen to committees and listen to submissions. I wish there's something glamorous and glorious I could tell you about this. It's not. It's a lot of binders. It's a lot of looking at ideas, assessing them, analyzing them, and starting to make some choices about what fits into the big picture and what doesn't. I continue to have private meetings, including private meetings with some people who are here today, about particular issues in the economy, like research, like innovation, like the issues in the nonprofit sector in Canada, the NGOs, and so on. And, of course, we did a lot of reading. I have to admit that during that time, I started to read FDR books. I've taken out most of them from the Parliamentary Library. They have a good collection, by the way, at the Parliamentary Library, which is also of some concern. But it was a time to sort of try to figure out how we were going to manage our way out of this economic decline. So what I learned from all of that, there was a moment, and I remember because it was at the meeting in Saskatoon where I'd been listening for a few hours, and it started to strike me that, okay, there are certain fundamentals here that we are going to have to do. And the first one, at least in my view, was that we had to be bold, that we could not be timid. That if we were not bold, we would be running a rather significant risk, downside risk, with respect to the Canadian economy. Now, at the end of the day, we were bold. It is a large deficit for this year, a large deficit for next year, and a deficit the following year, which is not so large. But this is a dramatic turnaround. For me as a finance minister, who had done three balanced budgets in the province of Ontario, to get to accept realization that what Canada needs is this kind of economic activity spurred by government. Why was it necessary? Because the investment is not being made by the private sector. Is that a proper role of government? Some libertarians and some conservatives would argue that it's not a proper role of government. I think we have to be pragmatic, quite frankly. One has to do what the country needs at a particular period of time. But the caveat there was we had to have an exit plan. We couldn't go back to the 1970s and 1980s, where governments of various stripes ran deficits year after year in relatively good times. And I was motivated to enter politics I didn't run in the 1970s, but I became a conservative in the 1970s because of the fact I was a liberal at one time. I shouldn't say that on the Amazon, but in the Trudeau Mania year in 1968, my sister was dating the local liberal candidate, and she made me knock on doors for him. And he was MP for 30 years. I'll leave. Won't mention his name. It wouldn't be fair. But I got over that in the 1970s. When I saw this thing happening, I just couldn't understand it. You know, here I was at that time a young lawyer working in a law firm. You try to manage what you're doing and the sending and so on. And to see the government being, in my view, profligate. And that was a motivation for me ultimately to get involved in public life. So we knew that we were going to have to run deficits. My own view was that we had to be bold on that. I also came to the realization that we were going to have sectoral problems in areas in addition to the auto sector. We already had the auto sector going on, serious problem in the province of Ontario, but it's a serious problem for Canada as well because it's an important sector of the economy. We're still working on that issue, but it was clear that forestry, manufacturing more broadly, were going to be challenged. It was also becoming clear that we're going to have significant unemployment this year, and we would have to take steps to deal with that. Some of them would have to transform the steps so that people in those industries, like I just mentioned, which will survive, which will be smart, that people will be able to transition, be trained for other jobs in other sectors and growing sectors of the economy. And as I say, it became clear that the investment would have to be made by government. We would have to keep research and development going also during the recession so that we would not get off our longer-term plan, Advance Canada, and we would accelerate out of the recession. Now, some of the caveats, we should only do things that we would do in any event, the deficits would be temporary, and that we would ensure that we had an exit plan. We did that, by the way, in the economic action plan. We put into the plan the rule that as we come out of the recession, surpluses that we will run 4 or 5 years out will be used, first of all, to pay off the deficits that we will incur in the next few years. This is important, because if we don't keep to the rule and we run into the danger of deficit after deficit, governments are not good at curtailing spend. I know I'm stating the obvious, but they're just not good at it. Once a program is in place, it tends to stay in place. And that's why our stimulus spending is time limited. Use it or lose it. At the end of 2 years, it will not be continued. So, talking about the sources of input, we were looking at the economic deterioration. We were listening to informed opinion. We were also looking at, or I was studying the lessons of history. Now, the Prime Minister is an economist, and he has his knowledge in that area. There's an issue of public confidence and psychology, too, that was important to take into consideration, because that's such an important part of what happens in any economy. But what really drove the policy decision-making, in my view, was just the pragmatic, what Canada needs now, this is what we have to do in order to cushion the impact on Canadians, many of whom would lose their jobs, that would need retraining, to make sure that we stimulated in those areas where we could stimulate because the private sector wasn't going to do it, to make sure that we kept lending going in this country and that government would have to be active in that because of the resonance of banks and some of the losses and the international need to fix the banks. All of those issues were ones that we were going to have to deal with in the So we did. In the meantime, there were a couple of other issues happening. Asset-backed commercial paper was an issue. Discussions have been going on for a long time, fostered by the Government of Canada. Bertie Crawford was leading the discussions to try to make sure that this Canadian-made problem was solved in Canada. It came from the private sector. It didn't come from government. But at the end of the day, in December, it was the Government of Canada, led by the Prime Minister, that brought together the Government of Quebec, the Government of Ontario, and the Government of Alberta. All of them had significant, not the Government of Canada, but the other three provinces, had significant exposure to this asset-backed commercial paper. We funded the final part of the solution to the problem, which was approved by this and was accomplished. We also had, at the same time, the pension issue, which is a serious issue, as many of you know. We have a consultation going on right now as the province do. The federal government regulates about 10% of pensions, but because of the decline in markets, many companies will be called upon to put more money into the pension plan, which can impair their own viability as businesses. And we also, of course, had the issues with respect to the auto sector, and the Prime Minister and the Premier of Ontario in mid-December made the announcement that we would participate with the Americans, assuming viability plans are produced by the Detroit 3. So all those issues were going on. I have to mention research and innovation because Heather did and because we're taking some flack for it here and there. And it actually concerns me because when I was a Minister of Finance in Ontario, we did a lot of work on research and innovation, a lot of investment, some of it in partnership with the Government of Canada. I recall Alan Locke being the Federal Minister of Industry, and I was the Provincial Minister, and we funded on an equal basis the Mars Center for Commercial Commercialization of Innovations in Toronto, which has been a successful enterprise. It's very important that we continue that. It's part of our Advance Canada plan. We do have strategic review in the government. What that means is that not every program in government goes on forever, thank goodness, that someone actually looks to see whether the program is still filling the purpose for which it was created. And what we did in past years, we had some programs that were not using all of their spending. For example, the Canada Research Year, because some of the universities, quite rightly, were doing intensive searches to get the right person from around the world to take a research chair. But it means the money doesn't get spent. So what did we do with money? We took the money and used it for other things, like the scholarship program, like an additional $750 million for the Canada Foundation for Innovation. There were no cuts. There were no reductions in spending. What there was a reallocation of resources for other parts of the research and innovation agenda. So that's important, that the continuation. As I said today, I want to talk to you one moment about the longer-term view for Canada. I really am quite encouraged today by the fact that the Government of Ontario decided to harmonize their PST with the GST. This is significant. We have a group of provinces in Canada that are still not harmonized. Prince Edward Island, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and British Columbia. With Ontario deciding to harmonize, this is a tremendous boost for business in that province. It means that 75 to 80% of Canadian businesses will now be able to do business in a harmonized way with the PSE and GST. The savings in Ontario alone are about $500 million in administrative costs alone for business. The savings for businesses overall in Ontario are about $5 billion per year. This is jobs. This is investment, this is jobs, this is good economic policy, which we've been encouraging the non-harmonized provinces to do since 2006. I am encouraged by that. The awkward reality that my wife, Christine Elliott, is the member of provincial parliament now for Oshawa, and the Progressive Conservative Caucus in Queen's Park decided to oppose this tax measure. And she sent me on the BlackBerry as we were driving in an interview that she did, where she was asked for her views on this about 5:30 this afternoon. She said, I don't have my BlackBerry, but it was something like, well, our caucus policy is that we oppose this policy of the McGuinty government, the report from the Toronto Star, as one would expect. So isn't this a little awkward with your husband being Jim Flaherty? And her answer was, well, then she pursued it. She said, well, isn't it really a bit awkward? And Christine said, well, I think we'll stay married, but I respectfully disagree with him about this. So that's, I thought it was a pretty good answer, actually. And I was glad to hear we're going to remain married. That step in Ontario action is important. What is likely to happen now is that the non-harmonized provinces will want to do this. What does it mean for the future? It means that a few years from now, hopefully, we will have a harmonized system across Canada, which will mean much easier accommodation for businesses and more job creation in Canada. And that's good for the country overall. Let me say finally about where we are, that when I look at the present situation, we are somewhere in the middle of this. One of the British bankers the other day was asked, where do you think we are in terms of trough and so on? He said, I think we are closer to the bottom. And that's a safe thing to say. We're somewhere probably closer to the bottom. This is going to be a difficult year. The banks have to be fixed internationally before we are going to have recoveries in the various economies in the world. That financial market situation has to be fixed. Canada's leading the way on this. Our financial system is looked at around the world as a model. It's become humorous internationally to refer to Canada's boring banking system, with other finance ministers saying, gee, I wish I had such a boring banking system as you have in Canada. So we're doing well in that regard. People look to our financial system, the way it's regulated, the way it's conducted, with admiration internationally. In terms of our stimulus, we're ahead of what the IMF asked each country to do, and which the G20 leaders agreed to do in Washington in early November. So we're on track as a country in terms of our international leadership by the Prime Minister, which I hope and expect will hold us in good stead next week at the London summit. And finally, let me say this, because I think it's important to have perspective in all of these. We will come out of this. I look around the room at the age of people. You know, you all remember the early 80s, prime rate, August 1981, 22.5%. The early 90s, you remember, and maybe some of you don't remember the 80s. So I made the mistake, and I'm going to stop soon, but I made the mistake, and when somebody suggested to me, from the Economic Advisory Council, actually, that we ought to fix the roofs of rinks, hockey rinks and so on. And I said, why are you saying that? And he said, well, most of them were built up to 1964, 1967. Because it was the centennial program, and that's when people built community things, and communities contributed, and the Rotary Club and all the rest got involved. So a lot of recreational space things were built in that period of time. I went back, and I was sitting with my staff at finance, and I said, you know, you remember that time all those rinks were built, 1964 to 1967, Bobby Gimby, Canada, and all that stuff. They all looked at me like, what's wrong with you? You know, most of them were born 1980 or 1985 or something. Anyway, we feel old, but we did it anyway, and we have the RIC program now. I love that acronym, where we are going to replace a lot of those roofs on hockey rinks across the country. But looking at things in perspective is very important. We'll come out of this. We are Canadians. We are resourceful. We are a strong people. We have the human resources. We have the great institutional resources, McGill University being a prime example. I hope and I expect that because of the measures we've taken in this policy-making in a time of crisis, that as we come out of the recession, we will come out strongly and we will accelerate strongly in Canada so that we will come out of it stronger than ever. I'm mindful of a fact I was reading the other day. We made a contribution federally to something called Ireland Park in Toronto. I did go to Loyola High School. I got to talk about it. Which is a park to commemorate more than 1,000 children who died during the Great Irish Famine who emigrated to Toronto. As you know, Gros Isle is here, National Park, east of Quebec City. When you put things in, you look at what they had, and so many immigrants, so many people came to Canada who were fleeing economic circumstances or political circumstances. They had nothing. Some of them couldn't speak either of the official languages. And look what they accomplished. And all we have to survive a few recessions, including this relatively difficult run right now. But surely we will, and we will come out of it stronger than ever. I've gone on almost as long as it seems. Thank you for being so patient.
I want to thank you. Merci beaucoup, Mr. Faraday. And now, in the great Institute for the Study of Canada tradition, I'd like to invite a student to thank you. It's Emmanuel Richez, the doctoral candidate in the Department of Political Science. Emma.
Merci, Monsieur le Ministre. Au nom du public, au nom de l'Université McGill et surtout au nom de l'Institut d'études canadiennes de McGill, j'aimerais vous remercier pour votre franc-parler et vous souhaiter bonne chance pour les années à venir. Nous apprécions grandement que vous ayez pu prendre de votre temps, de votre recherche pour être parmi nous ce soir. Now I'd like to present you with a small token of our appreciation. Merci beaucoup encore et on espère vous revoir bientôt parmi nous. Merci.